Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio. Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio, and today is Wednesday, November the 23rd, 2022, and I know everybody's getting ready for Thanksgiving tomorrow, so just letting you know that as listeners, we are thankful for you, and we're thankful for this show, and that we have the opportunity to be here to share it with you. Dr. Tim is on a trip with his family for the remainder of the week, and he's in a location where the internet and cell signal is very sparse. So he will be having us play pre-recorded shows. So today is an interview that he did with Guy Finley. So enjoy.
This is Mind Shifters Radio. I'm your host for the first hour, Tim Hayes. And we're grateful to have Guy Finley joining us today. In our Mind Shifters Radio show, we promote, we teach, and we support people in using very practical tools for improving the quality of their lives. And it's because our only guest for today, Guy Finley, talks so much about how there is nothing more practical than true spirituality, that it's a great honor to welcome Guy. Guy Finley is an internationally renowned spiritual teacher and the best-selling self-realization author. His books and audio programs have sold over 2 million copies worldwide in 26 languages. His seminal work, The Secret of Letting Go, is considered a spiritual classic. Guy is the founder and director of Life of Learning Foundation, based in Merlin, Oregon, and as well as being the host of the Life of Learning Foundation's Wisdom School, which is an online self-study program for personal self-discovery. His new book, Relationship Magic, Waking Up Together, is a practical guide that provides couples with the unique, enlightened tools to transform their relationships from mundane to magical. For more information, we encourage you to visit guyfinley.org, or Relationship Magic Book, all one word, relationshipmagicbook.com. And it's a great honor for me to have Guy with us because, as I said, he understands the same kinds of tools and principles behind the tools that we teach in the Mind Shifter support groups and on Mind Shifter Radio, and the tools that Dr. Michael Rice makes available on his website, whyagain.org. And beyond that, Guy brings a delightful writer's, artist's eye, a storyteller's voice to these deep truths. So, please, Guy, welcome. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome, Tim. I'm glad to have the time with you.
I would like to take a moment and let you save your voice a little and read for our audience a little bit of why I say you have the artist's eye and the storyteller's voice. From your
I'm
book,
all ears.
From your book, it says, all of our relationships are a kind of mirror. Standing before the mirror of our relationships, a ceaseless reflection of that relationship as it unfolds, we are given to see something about who we are in that moment. In this way, each relationship serves to reveal to us something we may not yet have realized as being true about our present nature. In other words, whenever I'm around you, there's the prospect of being introduced to a me, parts of myself, that I have not yet met. Here's an example of this powerful idea and how it works its magic in us. Maybe we're on a nature hike. When we round a bend, suddenly finding ourselves standing at the foot of a towering waterfall, majestic. A delicate mist covers everything, catching the sunlight, creating a million tiny prisms of colored light. There's never been such a moment for us because we have never been who we are in that same instant. In such moments, we are filled with an incomparable sensation that is one and the same as meeting a whole new level of our being. Or perhaps we look up to see an unending night sky. And in our relationship with that dark expanse, we experience the feeling of something deep and vast within us. We sense the presence of something eternal. In that moment, we are given a glimpse of something we would never see otherwise. The timelessness we feel stirring in us has always lived in us. Much as in the fairy tale, Sleeping Beauty is awakened from her deep sleep by the kiss of Prince Charming, so can all of our relationships with everyone, with anyone, serve to stir us awake, not only that we might experience some deeper, truer sense of self, but so that through that same awakening, we may touch and be touched by a higher order of love that can be realized in no other way. Can this man write or what? So that's why we encourage people to check out your book, Guy. We have people on the call who are students of this kind of work and anxious to hear more about your book and why you wrote it and how you got to this place.
Thank you, Tim. I enjoyed listening to you read the book. Look, we are, all of us, I like to say, sort of paraphrase, I guess it was something in the Quran, birds fly, fish swim, men pray. We are, as human beings, created to realize in our lifetime a relationship with the world around us, all of the people, all of the circumstances, every last touch. We are created to realize that within us is a possibility that thought will never touch. We know, because of the fine example that you read, not because it's mine, but it's something all of us can relate to, we know without taking thought that those moments are supernal, they're sublime. I'm asleep in one respect until something stirs me. And in the moment of that stirring, I'm awakened to an aspect of my own consciousness that without that moment, without that mirror, I don't know. Which means that in that same moment, and this is a very important idea, what I realize, while I've never realized it before, has always lived within me. Which means that my being, the potential of my consciousness, already contains within it, everything that I will ever experience. It's profound if we can wrap our mind around it, There is no experience that we will ever have that isn't already in our consciousness. That means that the task isn't to go out and create experience so as to perpetually realize, but rather to start recognizing that relationships in this life, whether they're just the relationship of looking out the window as I am right now at the morning break in Southern Oregon on the mountain, or it's the relationship of talking with someone that we love, those moments are revelations. And every revelation, if we understand it properly, means something that we have never seen or met before in ourselves is suddenly brought up into our awareness. In that moment, and that's key to the book and everything else that I write and teach about, we have a choice. And the choice is, what do I do with that revelation? For instance, when I'm with my wife, who I've been with for nearly 40 years, there are certain things about her that I know before she starts talking that what she's going to say, because I can see a certain corner of her mouth turn up, a twinkle in her eye, and I know she's going to start talking about something she loves. And I already feel that happiness, because in that moment, my wife is stirring in me a corresponding part that finds contentment with what she manifests. That's a wonderful relationship. But in that moment where I love the revelation of that part of myself that my wife awakens me to, in that same moment, what if her little mouth turns down? What if she has a look in her eye that says, I need to talk to you about something serious? In that same moment, it's a revelation. The task is, what do I do with that revelation? Because one, I embrace wildly for being something that shows me something about myself I like to see. And the other, I reject. And not because my wife is to be blamed for her attitude, but because it's stirring in me something parts of me do not want to know about. So when I reject the revelation, it's the same as rejecting self-realization. And that's to the point of it. Relationships are the mechanism, if you want, through which a human being becomes self-realized, but only when they understand the axiom, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Well, that means every shape and form of the teacher, not just the one that we like.
Wonderful. It's the idea that you're laying out opens the possibility that I can be okay with whatever unfolds as long as I use it as a teaching moment.
Yes. Look, in one respect, we say things like, I'm going to use it as a teaching moment, because our assumption is, whether we admit to it or not, is that somehow the world is revolving around outside of me, and that here come these select moments, and I should be open to them and receive the lesson. And that is the truth at one level, Tim. But the truth is, the world isn't revolving around me, outside of me. The world is inside of me. There is no self without relationship. I beg everybody to think about it for a moment. That's part of the old koan from Buddha's work. You know, if a tree drops a branch in the woods and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? What he was alluding to is the idea that everything in existence, everything that does exist, exists because of a mutual dependency. And without something to be aware of a moment, there is no moment, which means that the moment we're aware of is unfolding in our own consciousness. So the world I see is not outside of me. That's the biggest thing, Tim. That's the secret of gradually letting relationships free us, fulfill us, perfect us. We think the world we see is outside of us. It's the nature of our nature. Our senses divide us up into the things we see and feel and the self that thinks it feels and sees them. But the truth is, it's not that way at all. The world we see is not outside of us. And when we can begin to understand that, which we've just been proving, if I look up at that night sky and I feel the depth and breadth of an endless ocean of stars, I look out the window and here come the girls, about 8 or 9 deer that I've hand-raised over 12 years. Why do I want to go outside every single morning to meet the girls? Because when I'm with them, the union of their being and the consciousness in me that is revealed through that integration produces a revelation of something that is already inside of me. So though the girls are outside, the night sky seems to be outside, where is my experience of it? And isn't my experience of it my consciousness of it? If we understood that, we would stop blaming people, Tim. We would realize that there are parts of us that are hurt, things that have remained concealed, carried through time because we didn't understand our relationship to life. But we would gradually take every last one of these moments and allow the moment to do what it's intended to do, which is to introduce us to ourselves so that we have the overall, the whole experience of the moment instead of the one that this lower self selects to prove that it's right or wrong or someone else needs to change.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I have the I have a highlight from your book that says, as long as we believe that anyone else is responsible for our sense of well-being, we will feel it's our right to keep spurring them on until they get it right.
Exactly.
And this reminds me of Dr. Rice's definition of codependence. It says, whenever I think or speak as though someone else is responsible for what I'm feeling, what I'm actually creating with my own thought, I have just created a codependent relationship.
That's correct. Now, the only thing I would add to that is that we need to understand, and this is to the heart of my book, that it isn't I who creates a codependent relationship. That'd be like saying it's I who jumps in a fire. It's I who agrees to become an addict. There is a level of consciousness that we are presently living in and from, and it is asleep. It does not understand why it exists. It only has for its reason for existing the identity that is perpetuated through the illusion of this separation. So that if I become in a relationship that creates codependency, and all of us have and probably still are to some extent in a relationship like that, it means because I didn't know what I was doing. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, it's so, how do you say, it's an amazing thing. You talk to people all the time. Everybody says they want to learn. Everybody says they want to be realized. They want to grow. But the moment that comes along that indicates something's going on, here's an example. I just posted this on Instagram. Imagine an aspirant comes to see his teacher and says, teacher, I you know what, I'm as thick as a brick. I know I want to wake up. I'll do anything. I mean anything. I've come to that point. Please tell me what must I do to go beyond the point I'm at? To which the teacher turns to the student and says, are you sure you want the answer? Well, of course I do. I wouldn't have come if I didn't. Teacher says, all right. The problem is, you see, that virtually every moment in one way or another, something in you is denying reality. To which point the student says, I do not deny reality. Now, does the student know what he's saying when he summarily resists something that challenges the image that he has of himself? Or is the student asleep and the teacher's offering him a chance to at least consider that because of the images, the ideas, the beliefs that he has about himself, that he summarily rejects any moment that threatens that identity? That's the task, and that's what relationships provide, a way in which we can be suddenly standing in the light of an understanding that we have brought with us, in quotes, this level of consciousness has carried forward from time something that no longer serves any purpose at all. And since it serves no purpose in the real moment, other than, God willing, us understanding it's time to set it down, then if it's still acting in our name, saying, I do not deny reality, I am not defensive, I am not afraid, I am not angry, fill in the blank. If it's still doing that, then that's a limitation on the revelation of the moment. Because the revelation didn't come. Teacher wasn't judging the student. Teacher was saying, look, you know, dear boy, I love you, but you still have this incredibly defensive attitude born out of any moment that threatens some precious image you have of yourself, including being someone who wants to be realized. Because if you could see that you just got angry at being told that you're defensive, then you'd realize that there was in that moment a chance for you to see something has come with you into this moment. Here it is. Will you take a look at it? Will you let the light show you this limitation so that you can begin to realize it isn't the teacher's opinion, his approval I need. What I need is to wake up from the dream that without the approval, without something confirming me, I'm no one. Then we have a chance, Tim, to use every moment of our life for the purpose in which it is given to us.
As you're talking, I remember a story you told about the roving reporter who went out and discovered a road that wasn't on his map. And as he drove down the road, he saw people lined up standing in front of walls, banging their heads. And when he went out to try and talk to them and find out why they don't just walk around the wall, a wall came up in front of him. And the one person that he saw walk through the wall when he finally got his attention, the old man came back and he said, you know, how did you walk through that wall? And the old man says, oh, it's nothing. I just 11 words. Who I have been is powerless to take me any further.
Yeah. That's
and
it.
You get at that so beautifully in so many different ways in the book, and especially in terms of relationships.
Yes. Because that's, look, what do we fight over? What do any two people fight over? Not just man and woman, any two people, any two political parties, any two countries. What do we fight
over?
Well,
I don't know about you, but I fight over who's right.
That's right. That's exactly it, Tim. Because I have, in that moment, I'm sitting at a restaurant and minding my own business, and for whatever reason, somebody walks over and says, aren't you so-and-so? And maybe I am, maybe I'm not. And I might say, well, no, you've mistaken me for someone else. And then that person says, no, you've got to be. And any moment in which something challenges us, there's this sort of fight-or-flight reaction. Belongs to a lower level of consciousness, clearly no different than the deer or the lion. And in that moment where that part of the brain fires off, it feels threatened, and it can only resist the rest of the moment that it sees as being a threat to it. But if we examine that moment, what we discover is that, and this is very important, in our relationships with our partner, the reason that I'm threatened in an argument is because my identity is vested in my belief that you have to be what I expect you to be. And I don't realize that you need me to be who you need me to be, which is really a level of codependency that's sort of innate in these earlier stages of a relationship with our partner. Because we're bounded. Bonded, that's what I'm looking for. We bonded in the early days because everything you said and did tickled me pink. Everybody remembers falling in love. There's nothing that anyone can possibly do to you in those early days that you don't find delightful. And even the things you don't immediately like, you bury them because there's too much stuff going on that's good. I call that the woo-hoo stage of a relationship. You know, that's where, for all intents and purposes, you are bringing out the best of me. I didn't know I could be so fascinated. I didn't know I could feel that kind of, you know, thrill. I had no idea my body could experience that kind of jubilation, on and on. But by natural processes, that woo-hoo stage starts to morph into what we could call the boo-hoo stage. Instead of the best of me, you begin to bring out the rest of me, where parts of me that now have kind of, what does B.B. King say, the thrill is gone? You know, exactly. Now I'm starting to not just notice these, what I call imperfections in you, but they're starting to bother me. So I go from this wonderful, can't talk to you enough, be around you enough, to having these buttons that I didn't know could be pushed. And the real point is, and particularly what you brought up, the pattern begins to emerge where I blame you for pushing a button. But what I have to understand if I want the pattern to end is that you didn't create the button. It came forward through time with me in an unknown body of consciousness that carries these badges, these buttons, as the result of incomplete experiences that were met with incomplete understanding. So in the end, Tim, the pattern ends when we can learn as a partner to say to our partner, not outwardly, inwardly, you know what? Thanks. I didn't know that about myself. I had no idea that I felt like I couldn't possibly, no one should challenge this estimation of myself, that you should challenge my opinion. Who walks around thinking that they are everything that God created and no one should challenge it? But in us are those tendencies in a consciousness we're asleep to. Relationships bring up the content so that another kind of light, a new awareness, can begin to help us see it, realize it, and release it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. It's not you that's irritating me. It's our interaction that's showing me that I have an irritable little person inside of me.
Yes,
to quote you from a previous talk.
Yes, that's exactly right. And look how nice this is. I'll show you. Have you ever been able to fix someone, Tim?
Not yet. I'm still working on it, though.
You and I and everyone listening to us knows that even if we can get someone to jump through a hoop, that it isn't two or three times before they jump through the hoop, before they turn and snarl, and the resentment born of believing that they had to make us content, they feel for us because of their own weakness in jumping through the hoop. So we can't fix other people. And yet, I'm hoping everybody's following, you and I know that we've had moments where there were limitations in us that someone may have even called out, that we resisted. But where it lasts, because by the grace of the divine, by the grace of an act of love, the conditions required to reveal that level of unconsciousness keep coming back and coming back and coming back until one day you sit there and you go, holy cow, I never understood it. I never understood. I resented you because you didn't approve of me, instead of seeing the problem lay with the idea that I had to be approved by you to be worthy. It's a lie. But I didn't see it as a lie, and so the blame went forward in a pattern where I either pushed or pulled and tried to get you to be someone who would see me as I want to be seen. Why? To confirm an image I have of myself that no matter how many people confirm it, can never be made real. So in that moment, the healing takes place because the limitation has been revealed as an aspect of a level of consciousness I didn't know I was identified with. And in that revelation is the invitation for me to see the truth that sets me free. And it does. And funny enough, when I begin to see the problem in my relationship isn't the limitation I blame on you, but rather something I've yet to realize in myself, then I stop pushing to change you. And you get a chance to see where the limitation is. I call it the jujitsu of love. Because when I stop trying to throw you and just get out of the way, then you have no one to fight with, because you can't blame me for your pain when I stop arguing. Then you get to see what's living in you that's the limitation in our relationship. And when you have any two people realizing that the task of love and of that relationship is for each person through that relationship to become realized through it, to see where a limitation is keeping the perfection of love from manifesting. And the more we get out of the way, the more we realize there's an innate love that brought us together for the purpose of perfecting our relationship with it through our relationships.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about your book, is that you're talking about some of the practicality, and you're also talking about, as you refer to it, love, the higher kind of love that matters most.
Yes.
And how it is not and cannot be determined by what others do or don't do toward us. And you say, this should be evident after all. After all, what kind of love is it that gives itself only to those who give it back when and as expected? Besides, if there's one thing we should all know by now, it's this. It's never been in our power to make others love us as we would have them do.
Yes.
And so I really enjoy how you keep calling us to the idea that we don't have to do all of this work. The work will be done for us by that higher kind of love when we just do our piece. You know, you talk at times about in the book about creating the space where when I'm called to the negative reaction, I recognize it and I hold back in that, you know, jujitsu of love you're just talking about, and I leave a space where my partner can see their pain rather than me keep trying to show them how they're creating my pain, which of course blinds them, etc. One of the things I want to ask is, because you've got this wonderful multi-layers that you're talking about in the book, most of us come into these books like this and spiritual teachings with all kinds of old baggage. And one of the questions that suggested here in your literature is, how do we let go of any old bitterness that's built up between us and our partner, our family, our friend? I'd love to have you address that for some of us, because I know people are saying, yeah, there's just too much baggage. I can't fix this.
We have to have new knowledge, Tim. Before we can have a new mind, Christ spoke of metanoia. this idea that we need new ears to be able to hear, eyes to see. Because in this instance, and you've said it so well, and it's a delight to hear that you're mining that out of the book. In scripture, east and west, but mostly western, actually I think there's six or seven different kinds of love that are pointed out, but the most obvious are this kind of eros love, this very physical, and a philic love, which is like a brotherly love. Most of our relationships are based in that. And then there's the love that Christ and Buddha and every great prophet and saint on this planet talks about, irregardless of the branding of that through religiosity. And that is agape. That is this understanding that all of us, to some degree, know exists. And we know it exists through what I call divine dissatisfaction. If everything and anything in this world was the answer to making me feel whole, happy, and complete in a continual, constant basis, then by now I would know it. I would have it, or I've had it, and it didn't do it. That even means with my wife, whom I love dearly, my parents, God bless their souls, those people in my life that I love, I understand that the people in my life that I love are placeholders. They are manifestations of love that exist for the sole purpose, as I do for they, of helping me remember that there is another kind of love that I am called to know, to be, and to live in and from, that doesn't fight, that doesn't hate, that isn't afraid, that never separates, and that all of the relationships are moments in which, if we see it, by the very fact of seeing our impatience, our negative attitudes, that by the imperfection that is revealed to us in ourselves, about ourselves in that moment, it couldn't be revealed unless there was a perfect light there showing it to us. How else would I know I missed the mark if there wasn't something making it evident to me, not judging me, as we love to do to ourselves, because that seems to prove that we know what love is. No one who judges himself or herself knows the love I'm speaking of. Love doesn't judge. He maketh the sun to shine on good and evil alike, so said Christ about this divine love. So, yes, it's a stretch, and people are sometimes very bothered when they hear me speak of these things or write, because in our hearts, we all know we're missing the mark. We're so caught up with trying to find ourselves, prove ourselves, make of ourselves something, get others to validate what can never be validated, that our lives are just running around and running out of steam, running out of the daily bread, because we've not had the new knowledge, the true understanding that's everywhere around us, that is trying to say to us, Guy, look, man, and now I'm sorry for the long answer, why am I bitter? Why did that person come up in my mind again? My parents who abused me, that woman who betrayed me when I was 27, who I gave everything to and turned on me like that. And here's the answer to the question that summarizes everything I'm saying. And everybody, you might want to write it down because it's one of the most important things that I teach, at least in my language. As goes my attention, so comes my experience. As goes my attention, so comes my experience. It's a multi-layered principle, but we've covered it in the beginning. When I give my attention to Tata, the new little fawn, I feel all the little fawn qualities. I feel a tenderness, a gentleness, because my attention links to the consciousness of that creature. And in some respect, by the way, the consciousness of that creature links to my own. That's the hope for animals on this planet, of being raised gradually, if humanity can only begin to understand that responsibility. But I feel Tata. I feel that little, timid, beautiful creature. Now, my attention links me to that consciousness. Why, Tim, when my mind brings up that person who hurt me, why do I give my attention to that pain? Would I deliberately attend to something for which giving my attention to it gives me the experience of the recreation of that conflict? I would never do it consciously, which means that my attention is being used by a level of consciousness for the continuity of itself, and not for the continuity of what it says it's doing, because when it thinks about people that hurt it and that it wants to protect itself from or do something so it can escape them, it's not escaping the people or the condition. It's giving its attention to the condition that's creating its experience. And so it's actually reliving unconsciously the very thing it says it doesn't want. And that's why bitterness and hatred and anger doesn't go away, because we've yet to awaken to realize there is a part of our consciousness that loves to reincarnate those things, which is why we don't learn from the past, which is why history repeats itself, because there's an unconscious nature believing it knows the purpose of the moment, when instead that consciousness is perpetuating the very moment it says it doesn't want. Sorry for all of that, but I had to get the whole thing out.
Well, no apologies necessary. I'm just sitting here thinking, boy, am I glad this is recorded so I can go back and listen and take more notes. I have so many things going on in my head. I love the idea you talk about how it's these different things are in scale. And when you said my attention, when it goes to an old bitterness, being used by a level of my consciousness, not
yes.
my true self, but by a level of my consciousness, simply to ensure its continuity.
Yes.
Because why else would I keep going back to the pain? I say I hate the pain, but
exactly.
my mind keeps going back to it. And so it's not my volitional mind, clearly, because what I would choose in this moment is to focus on Tata or some other loving interaction.
No, listen to me. What I would choose to do is be aware of the fact that something in me, by resisting my past, is recreating it. Resistance is a secret form of attraction. Resistance is a secret form of being bound to the thing I'm resisting, so that I don't need to think of Tata when I'm unhappy. That's resistance. What I need to do is agree to be aware of that level of consciousness that wants to recreate itself. Why? Because a level of awareness that can see that consciousness is already above and beyond that consciousness. It is showing me something concealed that in its revelation is released, because no one would consciously hurt himself or herself under any circumstances.
Right. So what you're saying is, if I try to get out of my negative state by focusing on a positive thing, it's just the same part of my mind trying to
yes.
escape something.
Yes, absolutely.
And the only liberty comes from realizing that what drew my attention to something that generates pain is a level of consciousness.
Yes.
It's just trying
because
to keep rolling.
Yes. Because if I'm aware of it, suddenly, for the first time, the wheat has been threshed from the chaff. I have come out from amongst them. A new level of self, a new identity, if you want, the beginning of conscience, the first advent of Christ consciousness appears. That light, that awareness, knows these things are not only who I am, but that they exist for the purpose of this revelation. Did you ever think about that passage, which makes no sense to most people? Very, very important in our relationships with others to love thine enemy? What in God's name does that mean? How can I love my enemy? Ah, the moment in which the revelation brings up this anger, this resentment, this fear in me is the same as the moment I'm invited, if I'll be present to it, to see that level of consciousness. So he prepares a feast in the presence of my enemies. My enemies have no authority unless I don't want to have an enemy. Can you follow that?
Yes, I think I do. I'm put to mind of Dale Ellen Hoffman, who talks about the ancient Aramaicans as one of the definitions for enemy from the ancient Aramaic is anyone or anything in the presence of whom I hold my breath. So
yeah.
When I resist an event, that's the creation of this tension. And the revelation that's in that moment that I'm rejecting that you're talking about, that's the gift. That's the banquet.
Yes, and I don't want to put words in the mouth of this fellow, but I love that the Aramaic, because what is that really saying when I hold my breath? What is the Ruach Adonai, the breath of the Spirit? So here I am, and in the presence of this thing, I hold my breath. I'm cut off from Spirit. And not only am I cut off from Spirit, but to the point of everything we're saying, in that moment, because I'm caught up in this loop of a nature that summarily resists anything that challenges the image it has of itself, then that same nature says, here, guy, I will be your guide. Here's what to do. Protect yourself. Defend yourself. Go make $1 billion. Do this, do that, and you will be free. That's exactly the same thing as a false god. That is a false guide appearing as light, but that's actually born of the darkness that I don't know I'm in, which is why I don't know that guide to be false and dark. I hope I'm not getting too carried away here, Tim, too deep.
Well, it reminds me of how you say so clearly in so many other talks that when I listen to fear, fear is only going to tell me what to do so that fear can run my life another day, another week, another month.
That's it.
And it also puts me in mind of, you know, you must have been doing some Krishnamurti reading over the years, because Krishnamurti has so many people say, okay, so now I see this, now what? And he says, well, if you see it clearly to its source, it loses its power over you. You don't have to decide what to do next. If you see actuality in the moment, it acts on you, and you act from that. There's a flow. You don't have to ask and think about what to do. You just do.
That's it. Yes, that's right. Look, if you pick up a hot skillet, do you need instructions to put it down?
And to save your voice for a minute, I really like what you said in one of your talks about how I don't have to keep reminding myself consciously day in and day out after I've burned myself on the skillet, stay away from the hot skillet, stay, because it's there.
Right.
I don't have to keep thinking about it.
Exactly. And it's the same thing, Tim, when it comes to relationships. I say when I'm negative with my partner, that they produced this pain in me. They did not produce this pain in me. They revealed there is a pain in me that I have yet to be able to understand and heal. And when I understand those moments, then instead of turning and letting my pain push back, I'm present to this unhealed part that has been concealed, and the work is done by the revelation, the light of that awareness. Because who would live consciously carrying around something that creates conflict for them? When I do that properly, then I begin to enter into a different kind of relationship where, you know what? Have you ever been upset with your partner where you were blaming your partner for your pain, but you could see, at least in retrospect, before I get upset with anybody, I'm in pain. Before I get upset with anybody, there is a pain in me. I don't understand that that pain in me was there before I found someone to blame for it. My partner has the same circumstance. And you get to a place where both people are in pain and neither one knows their partner is suffering, because all that nature is concerned with is its suffering and what has to be done to get rid of it. Well, when you understand the pain belongs to a level of consciousness that is only interested in keeping it alive through this seemingly divided relationship where people are different, we're not different. We all want the same thing. We want to be whole, happy, loving human beings, but that don't understand that isn't something we create. It's something we're being given and shown moment to moment through our relationships.
Yeah, you're right back to the idea of the mirror that was in the quote I was reading from the beginning. On page 100, you say it so simply, no one, no event is the sole cause of what we see as disturbing us any more than a mirror is responsible for showing us something in it that we would rather not see.
Exactly. You know, you walk into a room, there's five people there, and you can feel the negativity. They've been fighting. They could be dead silent. You would know they've been fighting. Why? Because suddenly you can feel the negativity in you. But if you don't know that the negativity is just a kind of mirror effect, a resonation of certain vibration, then that nature will say, boy, are these people negative. And suddenly you're negative. Instead, you could walk in and feel the negativity and realize I need to be very awake now because I know something in me can feel what's going on, and I need to be the witness of it, not its unconscious instrument.
Well, there's a challenge. There's a challenge.
Oh, yeah.
And part
so beautiful,
of me was...
But see, Tim, you hinted at it. It's not up to me to fix.
Right, right. It's up to me to see the insanity. You know,
that's it.
I mean, we have this culture where we're programmed to think you made me angry, you hurt my feelings, et cetera, and yet we're not aware of how well we've been programmed. Now,
exactly.
At one and the same moment that I could see how ridiculous it is for somebody to get mad and smash a mirror because they don't like what it's reflecting to them, I think nothing of blaming my partner for the anger I feel. And yet, as you just laid out, it's the same thing.
Yes.
So I can't see my own insanity unless I slow down and begin this process of creating that space, as you talk about in the book, to resist the moment where some part of me tells me to do a reaction or a negativity or a blaming, and to just
observe.
What's one of the best ways to start with that? How do I, from your experience, begin to build that strength of the part of me that can take a breath and hold back that negative reaction? Any tricks you have, any tips for us in that regard?
Absolutely. But let's be clear. We're not holding back the relationship. We're just not expressing it. That's different. We're not denying it, and we're not expressing it. We're witnessing it. An example, a couple, partnership of some kind. And one of the partners has had a tough day, come home, and the other partner sees the partner who's had a bad day come in, and because they know the look on that person's face, they immediately say something like, "Do you have a tough day?" To which the partner then begins to say all the things that went wrong with the day. Now, the more the one partner starts to unload, the more the other partner starts to wish they never asked, because now they're getting negative too. So here comes the stop, drop, and endure exercise. Stop, drop, and endure. We've been studying these ideas, let's say one of the partners, and they realize they can feel the momentum of this negativity starting to ramp up, and they want to retort. They want to say something. You're always negative. When are you going to have a good day? Blah, blah, blah. Some passive-aggressive statement. But we know that when pain answers pain, the response will be more pain. So we're going to become, you ready for a beautiful word? Do you know the original meaning of the word patience, Tim?
Something to suffer myself?
Yes, to suffer myself.
Can you help us? Because when I've heard this in your talks before and tried to share it with people, their interpretation is I'm telling them they need to just suffer and accept suffering. And the archaic meaning of that has more to do with what you just said, enduring myself, allowing.
Yes. Yes. It is a way of understanding that I have to date been someone who in this circumstance always shoot first and ask questions later. I'm going to deliberately, as best I'm able to do, in part because I understand that nothing that's a part of a pattern can bring the pattern to an end. Nothing that is a part of a pattern can bring the pattern to an end. But if there is something in me that knows that as true, that's already outside of the pattern. Now I must act the knowledge of not being part of the continuation of the pattern. But that doesn't mean that that pattern and that nature isn't in me. So I am going to be patient. I am going to stop in the midst of its appearance and drop all the habitual vocalization, mentation, emotional response, and become the witness of it, so that I'm going to endure the manifestation of my own lower consciousness. I'm literally going to agree to die to it and for it. This is a crucifixion. I'm not going to identify with it. I'm going to let it come up, and I'm going to watch it die. And it will, because that unconsciousness, that level of sleep, is mechanical. It only exists as long as we are resisting a circumstance. And the minute that we agree to be the observer of this resistance instead of its instrument, it only has so far to go. So I stop, I drop all the thought, the feeling, being the witness of it, and I endure that nature until I see it fade from sight. And if I will do that, I will see the authority that nature has had over me. I will understand the great myths like Rumpelstiltskin and why when she finally knew the name of the creature, she gained authority over it. The old meaning of gaining the name, meaning you knew the phonetics, you knew the energy source, so that she was above the little evil thing instead of participating at its level of trying to make peace with it. This is what we have to work at, Tim. And it all can be done. We're created to succeed at understanding this relationship.
Wonderful. It reminds me of a beautiful story you have of a man who was raised and he woke up and realized, you know, I'm kind of a slave here. But the master was, you know, not so bad. But over time, he decided to research freedom. Eventually, he realized that you can learn all that you want about freedom and that you'd never get free. And
right.
Then finally, you know, the punchline of the story was he went to the master and said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And the master said, you have to. And he finally said, you know, the master said, I'm the law. And the hero in your story finally said, I am the new law.
Yes. And he becomes the new law by understanding the only authority the master has over him is his mistaken belief in the authority of the master.
Exactly.
When we become the new law, we are made new That's what you're alluding to.
Right, and what you talk about in all of these stories is you're not talking about an external master. All of these stories are the internal, that
yes.
I have been a slave to a part of myself, a level of consciousness within me that's going to continue its part in the pattern just so that it continues. But
yes.
that nothing in that pattern, no part of a pattern can bring an end to it. So I have to become aware of a, as you talk about so well in the book, a higher level of love, this higher order in scale of this force which can awaken me to potentials within me that I've been asleep to.
Yes. And the beauty of it is it's already there, Tim. It is the very basis of our being. It's just that we have, to use words, kind of fallen into this level of consciousness where a false light, an imagined light, has replaced the real one. Every time we save ourselves, fix ourselves by trying to become what someone else or what we think the world tells us we have to become, without knowing it, we are following a false guide. And that false guide lives to create false relationships so that in the pain that ensues, it can strengthen its authority. We can change that by understanding what it means to want to see the truth of the moment more than we want to prove that we already know it by getting negative.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I just looked at the clock and realized you've been very generous and given us a full hour of your time, and we want to be conscious of your energy expenditure because you're promoting this in many places. As we wrap up, a couple of things. One is last comments or statements you'd like to make, and perhaps tell us a little bit about your Life of Learning Foundation and what might be coming up there. Do you have talks in the pipeline starting soon? What's happening?
Yes, thank you, Tim. First, listen, if anybody's interested, my foundation, Life of Learning Foundation, has created a very special offer. And if you go to relationshipmagicbook.com, one word, relationshipmagicbook.com, and order the book through that site, not only will you get the best price, but you will get an audio book, the audio version of the book that I read. You'll also get a free 3-hour webinar based on relationship magic and a 60-minute MP3 download. So you get three really great gifts when you go to relationshipmagicbook.com. Now, if you don't want to order, for whatever reason, through that link, you want to go someplace else, come back to that link and merely provide the order information, the order number, whatever it is, and we'll still give you the gifts. So relationshipmagicbook.com.
That was an awesome interview between Dr. Tim and Guy Finley. And so that was pre-recorded. And Michael is with us. And welcome to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Glad you're here. We get to play with Arya Rain today again, and we've had an awesome morning eating grapefruits and a new cereal and having lots of fun. And beyond that, we are ready to get into this conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness. I had feedback from a few people yesterday that they really enjoyed tapping into the definitions that we provided in the Mind Shifters, addressing the emotional states that we did yesterday. So I'm going to pick another one today, but first I'm going to check with Jeannie and see if we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room, sweetie. I think she's turned to a conversation with Arya. Give me just one second. Let me catch up with her here.
Apologies. I had a little girl in the bathroom.
I could hear her voice. I could hear her talking there. So, and she's definitely, you know,
okay.
Back a few weeks ago, I had some conversation with Zaria on the show, and I understand some people left the show during, and I just want to make the point, if you happen to have been there and were one of those who decided to leave, you maybe missed one of the most important points of this work, and that is that these little ones are key, and our attention to them, whatever's going on in our world, is of premium importance beyond all the demands of the world. Just as a thought. So I hear you, sweet dear heart. And but I was checking to see if we've got anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room.
You do have a hand up. And it is,
well, then let's say hello.
541. It's Miss Celinda. Hi.
Hello. How are you this fine
lady? Welcome, young lady.
I, too, really enjoyed your presentation yesterday, and I'm so grateful, Jeannie, that you put all those quotes in the note, because I realized that I was holding my breath when I was trying to write those notes down. So I took that one, I took that little thread and saw where it led me to, and that was my need to get it right. So there we go, another little onion layer unfolding that I can just throw that one
Sweet.
Out.
Sweet. Well, then probably today's, what I'm going to do today will probably just fit right in with that conversation. So awesome.
Beautiful. Now, speaking of Aria Rain, by the way, what is her last name?
Shaw,
or
S-H-A-W.
That's what I thought, because I've always addressed the packages to her with just Aria Rain, R-E-I-G-N, right?
Right, R-E-I-G-N, yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
Her middle name is actually a family. She has a middle family name from her Filipino family. Oh, okay, Aria. Aria's listening. Hey, sweetie.
I'm Shaw.
And what's your two middle names?
Aria Rain Cadayonashaw.
Aria Rain Cadayonashaw. Cadayona is her Filipino family name. Her mother,
is that
her mother's mother.
Yeah,
C-A-D-Y. Cadayona. C-A-D.
Y-A-E-N-O.
I-A.
I won't put that one down. I'll put Aria Rain Shaw. Is that
yeah, that'll
enough?
Be plenty. That'll be absolutely.
Okay. So
And it's R-E-I-G-N.
R-E-I-G-N. Right. I got that one right.
Rain, yeah.
Good.
And she wants to know why your name is Celinda.
Because it was my great-grandma's name.
Hmm. Sweet.
And Celinda is from the Latin, and it comes from beautiful heavens, basically. Remember the Hispanic song, the Mexican song, Ay, 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 Celito Lindo?
Ay, 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 ay. That one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Linda or Lindo is beautiful in Latin and Spanish and a lot of others. What, Aria Rain?
I'm playing with sand.
She's playing with sand.
Beautiful. Are you making a sand painting?
I'm trying to make a wrinkled cake with sand.
All right.
Awesome.
Cool beans.
Cool.
Okay, this
Plus
is
a neat history on your name, Celinda.
Oh, thank you. If we only knew how much resonance comes with our names, and very often how apt those are to our purpose or our being.
Well, it's interesting, Celinda, as you were explaining it, and when you talk about the energy of it, as I was listening and you were explaining that, I had a vibration, literal physical vibration, going through from my mid-back to the base of my spine. I mean, it was just like your words, your description just opened this space of, I mean, really high tingling energy movement in my spine. So who knows what that's about, but it was interesting to observe.
Well, you know what Michael's from, right?
Say it again.
I think you're
there. You
Michael.
Go.
Is that the beloved of God?
I think
you
yes, and the archangel. I choose to identify with the archangel.
There you go. Well, I think that Michael, look it up because I may be mistaken. My first husband's name was Michael, the beloved of God.
Yes,
I believe what it is. So
yep.
Another little thing. There is a package coming that I would love to have you all open up before Christmas, like as soon as you get it.
Okay. Did you hear that, Arya? Celinda's sending you another package. How cool is that?
She's nodding her head.
Yeah. Well, I hope she likes it. They're just sweet little things that if I were a little girl, I would love them. And
nice.
Arya,
thank you.
You must know I'm a secondhand rose, so I find all these little treasures in all these little places, and I rescue them, and I share them with those I love. So there you go.
Cool. Sweet.
Some of them may have a little flaw in them, but then I just think, well, you know, we all have our little flaws that we are here to work with, and so that's good. So there you go.
Sweet.
Oh, and there's no, I won't say any more, just in case it's in the Christmas package that's coming. So,
cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, any other thoughts, questions, anything else to share from what moved it for you yesterday?
Yes. One other thing I noticed. Long mind shifters seem to distract me or... and so I tend to really break them apart, and I make them into individual mind shifters. Very simple, very. I used to think I was this wonderful, erudite person with all of these university degrees. Well, just one, and that I was so important. And now what I realize is what really works is simple. 10-cent words, and the simple things that always come from the heart.
Cool. Sweet. Well, I've got another long mind shifter for you today, so you can break it up as appropriate. That'll be perfect.
Well, as long as Jeannie is willing to put it in the notes, then
I'm ready to type.
Okay, I'm listening.
All right. Well, any other thoughts for you, young lady?
That's it, other than this mind shifter that I'm waiting for. And
it'll come,
come
down the pike in a few minutes.
That's right.
All right.
You three take care.
Have a blessed one.
Blessings
all right.
to you all.
Give Larry a hug for us, and happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, same to you. We got invited to our co-host family dinner. So, wahoo, we're so excited.
Nice.
They are such
cool.
sweet people. Bye-bye.
All right. All right, bye-bye. Blessings. Okay, Missini, anybody else with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it's all quiet. So, go for it.
All right. Cool. Well, the emotion I decided to address today, and we're just going to do the one, is guilt. That's a big one in a lot of people's lives. And as I really worked to put this one together and spent some time on it, realizing the complexity of it and kind of the dual use of the word. So guilt as a fact, is different than the emotions attached, especially in our culture, to the concept of guilt. I think there are, you know, I think every culture would use the word or a similar concept of guilt to imply responsibility. You know, properly used, it's a term that points out the party that's responsible for some form of actual wrongdoing or offense that goes against a rule or a law. So there's that use of it, and then we'll see there's a second, the big part where the work needs to be done. So when we look at this word law in today's confused world, clarify the word law so that we can understand the usefulness of the word guilt, because it is a useful word. It has a place. As an emotion, my offering is it's purely destructive, but as a concept, it can be useful. So, clarifying law. Law, and we're going back to the Aramaic now, is not what our culture would consider to be the word law. In our culture, you know, the word law is the rule of a superior. And our culture would dictate that the superior's rules have to be followed. Now, they could be totally and completely out of harmony with law. But our culture would say, well, we've got a statute. You know, technically speaking, the so-called laws of this culture are statutes. They're not laws at all. No man could ever pass a law, because law, as opposed to being the rule of a superior, is simply how the energy system works. It's the way within the actuality of this energy system that we call life, the way that system works. You know, the law, you know, that I bring up often, that I repeat, because it's been so violated in our culture, a la Yeshua from 2,000 years ago, was where he's asked, what's the most important law? And he doesn't answer, love God, love neighbor as yourself. That's not the way it works. You know, in law, in Aramaic, is the way it works. It's just the way the energy system works. So what Yeshua answers in that case, and it ties in here to get clear on the difference between guilt as a description of responsibility for an action and guilt as an emotional disorder, as a series of thought disorders. So in Aramaic, he tells people how it works to function as a human being. And what he says is, you must have rachma, filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that went open. It's a gateway that allows human life to enter the human form. And human life is love. Love moving in a human energy system is life. Anything that inhibits life would be against the law, against the way it works. So in that particular case, Yeshua answers them, have rachma when you think of neighbor, when you think of the creator. In other words, you know, and they're pretty much, that's the limit of the objects of attention you can have in terms of the human world, is your neighbors. And in Aramaic, the word neighbor means anybody that you think about, and the creator. So he's saying, you need to keep love present. You need to keep your human life alive. So have rachma when you think of creator, when you think of neighbor. And then, as opposed to what the Greeks translate to is, and you love them like yourself, in Aramaic, it's in order to maintain self. So when rachma is active, you maintain awareness of yourself as love. And therefore, you have a human life. That's the way human life works. And that's essentially the question that we're asking in that particular case. So I use that to illustrate what I mean by the word law. So one who violates or goes against the flow of life, or in the case of this culture, the rules men have made, is labeled guilty. And all that means is that they're responsible for a particular act, for what has occurred. And if you don't mind, I just took a second to add a note there. So Now let's move into the confused world where run by the minds of men and carbon-based memory rather than by law. And in this confused world today, all that needs to happen is for one to be on the other side of a belief that's held by any given individual to be judged as guilty. You know, you look in the political realm, and you notice that everything that's hurled out, no matter what somebody does, they're guilty simply because they're on the other side of the equation. Now we've moved out of the realm of the fact of guilt, responsibility for a behavior, and we have to begin to address, and this is really the core of the reason why I decided to go for this one today, need to address guilt as the destructive emotional state that it is. So, and recognizing what it is, number one, realizing that it's healable, and two, that it's a composite emotional, it's made up of many factors. So, guilt as an emotion is rooted in a complex of thought disorders. And in order to be free of this emotion, as we define it, each of the thought disorders that contribute to this complex needs to be individually addressed and forgiven. So, you know, one might end up doing 2, 10, 100 worksheets around guilt as an emotion to address each and every aspect of that, the thought disorders that go into this complex that we call guilt as an emotion. In order to be free of it, each aspect of it's going to need to be addressed and forgiven. So this complex includes thoughts based in fear, fear of rejection, fear of derision, fear of punishment, fear of harm, fear of loss. Each of those is a different thought disorder. Now, somebody might be, you know, when guilt as an emotion comes up in them, might be totally focused. Their thought disorder might be all about being rejected by, let's say, their family or their culture. Where someone else might think of, you know, their thought disorder behind their guilt might be that they're going to be harmed. You know, if they had a parent who enforced the, you know, the family law with a fist, then it might be harm that and punishment, the derision aspect of guilt. It might be about loss. It might be about being blamed. And it might move up to and including death. Each thought that would produce one of those things I've just described in any given mind is part of the complex of thought disorders that often makes up what we call the emotion of guilt. So as such, guilt is based in fear. You know, yesterday we talked about fear quite a bit. If you missed that show, you might go into the archives, go to our website, whyagain.org. And Jeannie, I'm thinking maybe we take today's show and what we did yesterday and put them together. And actually, I'm going to run through more emotions as we go through future shows. But so guilt is based in fear and closely related to shame, which we talked about yesterday. So you might review those in this context. It's a mix of thoughts resulting from a negative moral self-evaluation and thoughts of self-criticism that makes the error equating oneself with one's behavior. So if, you know, strictly speaking, the actual term guilt would be responsibility for a negative behavior. But when I step into the moral realm and I start mixing negative thoughts about I'm wrong, I'm bad, I'm guilty, I did something that hurt somebody, and on it goes, And then one equates that unconscious complex. Rarely is somebody in touch with the specifics of what the guilt is about. It's something that's been purposely instilled in most people. But if you make the error of equating yourself with your behavior, where, you know, perhaps you have transgressed a real or an imagined rule, or maybe you performed a harmful quality of thought, attitude, action, and behavior, and when that happens, it's often cultural or religious. So as such, thought disorders resulting in the emotion of guilt is often purposely instilled by so-called superiors in order to prevent a particular behavior or behaviors. You know, and I think it comes from the errant thinking, the thought disorder in the mind of the superior, that if I can instill enough guilt in this person, then they'll stay away from this behavior. If I can instill enough fear, enough derision, enough, you know, self-disrespect or disapproval from others or from me, the authority says, if I can instill enough of that, then maybe they'll never do that behavior. But what they haven't understood is it because this whole process is based in disordered thinking, it's going to backfire. It's going to produce exactly the result it was intended to avoid. Because it comes from, rather than thinking in harmony with life, in harmony with law, all of that guilt stuff is based in disharmony with law. It's out of order with law. It's itself is off the mark. And what happens when someone has been had guilt instilled in them, especially from an early age, and you know, the number of different thought disorders that get collected. Remember, we've talked about the file folder effect. When someone, you know, if you think about someone's file on negative thinking about self, the collection of thoughts that are there might be something that's been gathered over a period of decades in relationship to parents, in relationship to authority figures, in relationship to civic or religious figures. It can be a huge complex of, you know, I'm broken. If you remember the chart, the physiological effects of emotional suppression, this guilt one ties right into the first thought disorder that takes us out of our natural state. And my offering is we are naturally designed to live in enthusiasm. If you look at the child, how enthusiastically they come at everything. And in theos means in love, connected to love, in God, literally. And that's what we're designed for. But when the child is rejected by the authority and given a thought disorder, offered a thought disorder about how you're broken, there's something wrong with you. That thought creates pain, and that pain disconnects one from the awareness of the presence of love. And so now the authority that plays on that to instill guilt in a child is simply instilling disintegrative energies that are totally and completely against the law. And the child ends up with this whole complex that when resonated into activity has many, many, many goals attached to it. You know, each time the child went back to the adult in enthusiasm and got beat down verbally, emotionally, physically, there was a different goal that the child had. The goal to be approved, the goal to be accepted, the goal to be treated lovingly, the goal to be treated fairly, the goal to be honored. I mean, a thousand goals involved there. And remember that, pardon me, each time that a goal is active in the mind, there is a stress created. And you'll remember the power person workshop and or aspect of the codependence work, and that is that when a power person dynamic is instilled in a child's mind, and it's usually between a child and a parent, although not always, but when that's instilled in a mind, and it's instilled when the parent, again, usually a parent, has more power over the child than the child has. The parent is not functioning out of love, is literally not functioning as a human being, and the child perceives it as survival. When that happens, the child's energy field opens wide. And when their field opens wide, they are like a learning sponge. They literally, like, this is survival stuff. The child perceives this. They literally suck up, like a sponge, every energy in the environment. If the parent is in rage, if the parent's in pain, if the parent's in blame, if the parent's in guilt themselves, then the child absorbs those energetic patterns. Once that power person dynamic is instilled in a mind, it doesn't matter how many years later it is. It can be 2, 10, 50, 90 years later. When the stress is up and the chips are down, that person will behave out of that power person dynamic. In fact, their whole lives will be limited to just 3 behaviors. And the 3 behaviors will be based upon interactions with the power person and the level of stress that that individual is under at whatever stage in their lives that behavior is going to come out. The 3 behaviors are related, as I say, to the level of stress. When there's little or no stress, a person will do, their behavior will be whatever they did to get along with their power person. When stress starts to build, that individual will do whatever it is they did to resist and survive with their power person. It becomes a survival issue. And when that individual becomes ultra-stressed, they will then reach back into their memory bank and retrieve the behavior that the power person used to win over them, the behavior that they hated the most, and that's what they'll do to others. So all of the goals, recognizing that all of the goals from each time that a thought disorder related to guilt that's going to end up as this complex of guilt live in a mind and not canceled, stress builds. And that's why people end up doing the exact opposite of what the authority was trying to do with guilt. That's why it backfires. Literally, because of the energetic dynamics involved and all of the energy instilled in the way of guilt, it's like, whoa, bright, attractive energy there around that behavior. And this person moves in doing exactly the opposite of what the authority was hoping they would do. So because the confusion of the goals associated with guilt end up creating so much stress that one ultimately defaults to their most, literally their most hated person behavior. And so at that moment, then one tends to step into the pseudo-solutions of the non-being mind. That's where the non-being, it's such a, for so many people, it's such a huge complex of energy that it literally takes over the whole perceptual system. And now one starts to think in terms of pseudo-solutions. All of the things that their power person tried to do that never worked but were repeated, and one was lectured and told how this is the solution. Wait a minute, why was the power person instilling guilt in the child in the first place? Because the power person was under stress playing out their power person dynamic. And that leads to these pseudo solutions. That one gets locked into. And so for most people, there'll be many, many, many worksheets to be done. So our mind shifter for healing guilt. Whenever I find myself thinking negatively about myself, comma, or feeling the effects of guilt or blame. So whenever I find myself thinking negatively about myself or feeling the effects of guilt or blame, comma, I use that as a signal to become conscious of and forgive. So whenever I find myself thinking negatively about myself or feeling the effects of guilt or blame, I use that as a signal, conscious of and forgive even my most subtle self-invalidating thoughts. Now, if you happen to be new to the show and you're not familiar with the mind shifter, the simple use of it, you know, the idea is to use it as a resonating energy to surface things from the unconscious mind to strengthen the energy that of unconscious thoughts until they can pop through to the surface and come to awareness. So each time you write it, if there's a thought disorder related to this mind shifter, and, you know, it may be surrounded with all kinds of pain and trauma, and it's something you haven't thought for 50 years, it might be the 10th time you write this mind shifter that literally the resonance, the transfer of energy to that unconscious complex thought starts to move it till it comes to awareness, and all of a sudden, bang, there it is. So what you do is you take a piece of paper and you divide it down the middle and you write the mind shifter on the left-hand side. And then as you write it, pay attention to your breath. Make sure your breath is moving. The way that we keep things unconscious is by holding the breath. And an indicator that there's something unconscious going on in someone in response to something happening in the world is they hold their breath. The breath is the way to restrict the flow of awareness and mind energy within the system. So again, I'll run through the mind shifter just one more time to make sure everybody's got it. Whenever I find myself thinking negatively about myself or feeling the effects of guilt or blame. So, Celinda, you could break that one down to, you know, whenever I find myself thinking negatively about myself, then skip over, and then whenever I find myself feeling the effects of guilt or blame. I use that as a signal to become conscious of and forgive even my most subtle self-invalidating thoughts. So what I'd suggest, if this is a topic that's resonating for you, I'd suggest taking a time period of at least 3 hours. The cell phone is off. The telephone is off the hook or unplugged. The TV is off. You're totally focused in your own space. You've got a sign in the front door that says, do not disturb. And you write. And you write the mind shifter, and you write it, and you write it. And every thought that comes up in response to that, you record on the opposite side of the page. Once you complete that, give yourself an intermission from it, go back to it, and start to look at what you've written. If you really allow yourself to go into depth in a mind shifter, quite often when you go back and read what you've written, you won't even remember having read it. You won't even be conscious that it was yours. And it may not even look like you're writing. As Jeannie likes to point out, when she sees that her writing's gone off track, she'll start looking at, when she goes back to review the mind shifter, she'll start looking at, well, when did my writing, gee, I was in grade 3. What was going on in my life in grade 3? And that can cue one into what are the energetic patterns that need to be resolved in that situation. And so you've completed the 3 or 4 hours of writing. You take that writing and you go back and you read each thought that you've written on the right-hand side of the page. And if any more thoughts come, jot them down. The idea is to touch into the subtlest thoughts that most often we're so busy and we're so outer focused that we never let ourselves pay attention to. Here you want to really let yourself pay attention to what's in there. And then whatever you touch into that you realize is part of this complex of guilt or shame or self-blame, then you determine which tool you're going to use to resolve that. Let's, think of an example. So somebody's writing this and they touch into, I had such self-hatred when, my brother left and left home and never came back. Phew, self-hatred involves blame. So what am I going to do with that? Well, one, I'm going to sit down. Here would be my resolution on that. Here's the work involved in that. I would sit down and write a responsibility communication to my brother that maybe I haven't talked to in 20 years because he left in that situation. I'm going to do some forgiveness on the self-blame aspect of that. I'm going to dig out worksheets and do the forgiveness work there. I'm going to include in my letter to my brother the commitment. As I find myself holding my breath and feeling guilty about what went on with my brother, I'm going to go to the mirror. I'm going to read the commitment to myself and allow myself to become fully conscious of the thoughts of self-blame or self-deprecation that I have. And I'm going to forgive as to those thought disorders. So I'm digging up if we go to the opening words in the book of John, in the opening words of John, it does not say in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh. What it says is in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. What you're literally doing is you're learning the skill and the ability of digging into your own carbon-based memory, into literally your own cellular and genetic structure, and bringing forward those energetic patterns that in the cell express as dis-ease energies. You're bringing those forward with the idea of exposing them to love and therefore transmuting the energy, not putting the thought disorder back in the cell, but accessing the energetic pattern and by exposing it to love, freeing yourself of its impact. It's called healing. Healing does not come from taking a pill. Healing does not come from taking in a toxic substance that creates diseases. And you look at just about everything that's called, just every pill, take a look at the insert on the package and look at the diseases it causes. Those things are about treatment. Yes, they can get rid of a set of symptoms and can give you time to do the healing work, but the healing work will always remain your own. And so as I'm continuing to work around that particular situation with my brother and the guilt I had and the fear that I had, I might end up doing worksheets around fear. I may end up doing a codependent worksheet around the fact that while I had all this guilt and self-blame, I was also blaming my brother. So that might be what the end result of doing a mind shifter would look like. So I'd go through literally every thought that I touch into, and when I look at it and I go, is that based in love? Is that supporting love in my cellular structure moving through my cells? If not, then I need to be about forgiving it. I need to be about relieving it, removing it. Remembering that forgiveness isn't about letting somebody off the hook for what's going on inside of me, but it's literally the tool with which I go in and open what's going on inside of me and remove the energetic patterns that never belonged. And anything based in hostility or fear does not belong within the human system. And the reason for that is because when you put hostility or fear in any of its forms into the human cell, it inhibits the flow of love in the cell. It inhibits the flow of life. It's literally what death is made of. When you go back to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, and you notice he didn't say, I come to bring you dogma. I come to bring you religious dogma. How cool is that? I come to bring you a doctrine to live by. You notice he didn't say that. He very, very clearly said why he was here. He said, I come to bring you life and life more abundantly. In other words, I come to show you how to liberate your cellular structure of anything that inhibits love moving through it, of anything that inhibits your life flow. And remembering that, you know, the word that was used in Aramaic to describe that which inhibits the flow of love in the cell was the word sin. And that sin is an archery term. When you fire at the bullseye and you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper yells, sin, you're off the mark. All the word means is an energy that's off the mark. Every energy that's put into a human cellular structure, and oftentimes, sadly, these energies are put into the cellular structures of children by religious figures, by religious leaders, and by parents, who, if you asked either of them, would cherishes that child so much, but is ignorant of the fact that they're passing the sin of their generations, the energies that are off the mark, those energies from previous generations, they're just unconsciously, through the automatic decision system, being driven to pass those on to their children, to their offspring. It's insane, but that's what happens. And the key is this happens when people are under stress, have more goals than they can handle in the moment. That's when they'll default to those generational patterns. So if you recognize that there are energies within you that are off the mark, that inhibit the flow of love through your cellular structure, then turn to the teachings of one who knew exactly what life was about and exactly how to liberate. Stuff isn't about religion. This stuff lives right where you work, right where you have your children, your parents, your lovers, your friends, your spouses. That's where this teaching lives. And yes, you're going to move through the unconscious patterns of the generations and each thing. You know, this tool we just offered, this mind shifter, will open so much for most people of those generational patterns that need to be forgiven, that need to be removed. And when they're removed, when they're liberated from the cell, more love can flow through the cell. That's life. That's how we get to life more abundantly. This wasn't religious stuff. Just the way it works. So we're here to support it working for you and are delighted to have the opportunity to have this conversation. It looks like we've got about 10 minutes left, so maybe we could open the phones and see if we have anybody with a thought for us. And Ari is coming into the room to say hello to me. Hey, dear heart. Hey, sweetie. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do not. It is all quiet today. I don't know if people are getting ready to cook for tomorrow. And we do. We are down to 9 minutes. So we got time for a quick question.
So if you're out there in listener land, our calling number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show. And if you have a question, once you're listening to the show, all you do is push 1, and we'll be having a conversation.
TV or something is coming
through.
Yeah,
I muted it. Aria had just come in and she wants me to put a show on for her. So if you're out there in listener land, let's have a conversation. How can we?
All right. I'm not sure if you pressed one again. So, Linda, did you? The switchboard flickered. So, I'm not sure if you pressed one again or if just flickered.
No, I pressed one again.
All right. Well, you're back
great.
On.
What's up?
Well, I'm just a thought in relation to guilt and the hardening and the releasing, which would be the Greek version of forgiveness and the Aramaic version of forgiveness. And I was realizing that the Greek version of forgiveness was all they knew was responsibility. And so if someone were responsible and you decided to be merciful to them, so you pardoned them, basically what you were allowing them to be was irresponsible, and we see this in our culture all the time between people who have done heinous crimes in the eyes of society, and then some higher authority comes back and pardons them, and that's a whole nother conversation about the punitive system and everything. I don't want to go there today. But they had no concept of what forgiveness is. So pardoning would be the responsibility aspect of guilt or not pardoning, holding responsible. And the emotional aspect of guilt is in the forgiveness work. Am I having a helpful perception there? We want to dismantle the emotional disorder of guilt. And yet at the same time, we realize that there is the responsible aspect of guilt when someone has done something to harm something or someone else. And also I was thinking about love thy neighbor as thyself. So it's not just somebody, it could be, or someone, some human, another person, but it could be creation, for example. We are also responsible for our effects on creation, our aspects of creation.
Yeah, my take would be that where guilt equates responsibility, and to pardon, you know, to use language correctly, would be, in the Greek idea, would be nothing to do with forgiveness. It would be pardoning. So, okay, you did something inappropriate. I can see that you
right.
have, you know, the appropriate amount of remorse for what you've done, and you've had a change of heart. So we're going to pardon you. We're going to let you off the hook for that, and there's going to be no penalty. But the forgiveness
right.
work is really about going into one's own thought complexes. And in
right.
this particular case, which are deeply complex, and one by one addressing those energies that produce the result called guilt, and freeing one's inner space from those energetic patterns. And then what happens is one does that more and more. They bypass the Greek convention that you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself, which was never the instruction, and they get
right.
to realize, oh, I'm not here to love my neighbor. In fact, it's a terrible thing to tell somebody to love their neighbor, because if somebody has, let's say, has a guilt complex and they haven't resolved it, they're going to have neighbors show up that are going to resonate their guilt. And when
mm-hmm.
they resonate their guilt, there's going to be anything but love present for that neighbor. And
really?
So that's just going to tend to add more to the guilt. When we
right.
recognize that Yeshua never suggested or required loving your neighbor, when we recognize that, then we recognize that the idea was that you do the work required to live as the presence of love, not loving your neighbor as yourself, but being the presence of love and maintaining your human life. Now you come from that space of active love, which if your neighbor's in a conflict type situation, by your presencing love for your neighbor, you then facilitate the healing of your neighbor. You're really there on the team supporting your neighbor's healing as well as your own. That would be my take.
Right, and if you are, you communicated that much better than my garbled attempt to communicate it and added more, too. So if you go to try to love your neighbor and you have no love for yourself because you've got all of this disordered thinking between you and yourself, realizing that you are the beloved or you are loved by creation, then it's impossible for you to even attempt to do the act of being loved towards your neighbor. You can't do it because you hate yourself.
Yeah, and if there's self-hatred, then before one can realize themselves as the fact of love, that self-hatred is going to have to be forgiven.
Exactly.
And so I suggest that you remove the D from the word love, loved, because whenever you add that D, you know, he loved her, she loved him, I loved them, that always involves the false idea of that we can love one another. And we can't love one another because love isn't a verb. It's not something we can do. The D on the end of the word love indicates something we're doing. You can't do love. You either be love or you don't. And that's why I say I think it's destructive to tell somebody to love their neighbor, because their neighbor is going to show up and bring up whatever they need to deal with, and it's probably not going to be love in many cases. And so when the instruction gets clear that, oh, I'm here to be love in the presence of my neighbor, the word loved won't even come into the equation. It will simply be, oh, my effort, my goals, my work is about what do I need to do to remove from my structure what inhibits me functioning as love, and now I be the space. And in doing that, I'm going to tend to draw love out of my neighbor rather than the behavior that resonates my guilt or my fear that I need to work through. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think we have a different understanding or meaning that we've given to the verb to love. For me,
well, that's because
I cannot...
there is no verb to love. There is no verb. My offering is that's a misunderstanding. That's a cultural error.
Is that in the Aramaic you're talking about, or is that in English or Greek or any other cultural language you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about the fact in the actuality in the energy system. I'm not talking language, you know, is a destroyer of truth in many cases. So
right.
what I'm offering is that the fact of human life is that human life is love. And human life can't do love, it can only be love. So when I tell, and my mind is
okay,
a goal-oriented voice, when I tell my mind that I want to love my neighbor, I just set my mind off on a totally false path that can't be accomplished. When I recognize, oh, here's my neighbor and they're bringing up my hostility, I think I'll apply forgiveness to my hostility to remove that, and now I can be the presence of love with my neighbor. And when I am, it's going to tend to resonate the same in my neighbor.
So what I hear you saying, and I can honor that from my perception, from my understanding, there is the perception or the actuality of creation or creator itself, and there is also the little perception of the human dimension. So
right.
If I am
represented by language very inadequately.
Okay. So if I am,
the show's going to cut us off in a few seconds.
Okay, I will
go for it.
Continue.
No, go for it.
Okay,
we can just
okay.
run the show out as long as it goes out.
Okay, so if I am living within my reality and I am doing the very best I know how through forgiveness work to transform my reality to align it with actuality, I'm still living in the other, in this dimension of reality. So I'm using the languaging of others that don't have maybe the understanding I have from the heavenly position and the earthly position. I'm still going to be speaking earthly language. But what my meaning for the verb to love in earthly languages, is I, expressing as love, am actively, consciously present, presenting that love to others, sharing it, expressing it, extending it. And that, for me, is the definition of the languages or the cultures of the verb to love. I cannot love as a verb if I am not being love as a noun, as an actuality. So I am going to stick for me with the perceptions of this and that rather than cut off that. That I honor your doing that because you're coming from a certain perspective and I am coming from a different perspective. So I will accept both of ours for me.
Yeah.
And I admit,
cool.
And I make no demands to,
yeah,
to, you know, demands or agendas for anyone else to have
right.
that. And
well,
so I want to share
my offering. My offering would be, and the show's going to cut us off any second. My offering would be, you might want to listen to Yeshu, who says the power of life and death is in your words. And you want to make sure that instead of arguing for, well, I'm going to change the definition, you get to the real root of what the word means. And that is going to bring life. If we go with, well, I'm going to take the culture's ideas and I'm going to follow that, then my offering is if the word is off base, then it will tend to lead to behaviors that are not particularly supportive. So that would be my thought, my offering.